We're going on to the third point. Meaning in life is found in relationships. Now, many times your philosophy of life, the one that you write on paper, is one thing, and the one that you live is another. But just because you have a beautiful philosophy of life doesn't mean that you're a particularly good person. The way you check it is to ask yourself, now, in fact, the way I live and what I do, does it really reflect the things that I claim to believe? And I can't give you your philosophy of life, but I'm trying to influence you to think along certain terms and consider these concepts that we're talking about here in these sessions. So, tonight we're going to talk about the third one. Meaning in life is found in relationships. Now, that's not very profound. None of these statements are really very profound, but it's something that is very easy to miss, because it's possible, and very frequently, we treat people not as persons, but as objects, or as projects. And once in a while, we get around to treating people as people. Now, we treat people as objects all the time, and sometimes it's necessary. You know, if you have a slave around the house, you say, go do this, and he does it, and you don't thank him, you just expect him to do that, because that's he's doing his duty. You know, that's what Jesus said. And so you slave owners, why, you know how that is. But it's not only in the relationship with slavery that we treat people as objects, but, like you get up in the morning, and you live in a dormitory, you go down to the cafeteria, and you kind of stumble through the line, and food lands on your tray. And then you go over and you sit down and you eat it. You were served by people. Now, it really didn't matter to you at all that it was people that were serving you. In fact, you just assumed it would be a machine, when machines don't make as good food as people do. So you're served by these people, which you really treat as objects, because there's no really interaction there. Or if you live at home, you get up and your mother is that food dispensing object first thing in the morning. And so then you get in your car and you notice that the gas needle is on empty, like always when you're a university student. And so you stop at a gas station and you roll down the window and say 50 cents worth. And so someone rips a couple of drops of gasoline in your tank, and you give him the 50 cent piece, and off you go. Now, a person attended you there, but you didn't treat him as a person. You just he was just a gas pumper. And if we could perfect a method of pumping gas without people, why, that would just be more efficient, wouldn't it? And you pull into the parking lot, and there's a guy there who gives you a little ticket, and you give him some money, and you pull in and you park. And so that person was a ticket dispenser. And then you go into a classroom. Now, and there's the greatest object of all. There's that professor up there, you know, just talking. And you wish that it were on closed-circuit TV or something, so you could put your feet up on the chair without getting reamed out. But so the professor is an information dispensing machine. And so we go through life relating or having contact with people all the time, but not treating people as people, but as objects. And that's not necessarily bad. You can't stop. You know, you stop and you get 50 cents worth of gas, and you ask the guy, hey, how's your mother? You know? He's probably not in the mood to relate, especially if it's in the wintertime and it's 20 below zero. And so it's necessary many times to treat people as objects. But the problem is we do it at the wrong time with the wrong people, and that's when things begin to get complicated. For example, you get married and you get up and you're used to treating your mother as an object, and so there's your wife sitting across the table, and she's burned everything in sight and serving it to you, and you just inhale it and off you go. And lo and behold, she's offended because you treated her like you would treat your mother. And so you've got to shift gears when you get married, you know? Remember that. So then So, you know, as time goes on, the wife treats her husband as a money dispensing machine, and as a child spanker and a garbage disposer. And the husband treats the wife as a meal cooker and a clean shirt provider and stuff like that. And so It's possible. In a lot of marriages, that's the way it is all the way through life. Two objects under the same roof, both animated objects, but objects nevertheless, and there's never really any interaction between the two. Now, that especially gets sticky, what gets into the Christian realm. In business, our symbol of success is what? Bread, you know? The money you were able to carry to the bank. And you say, how successful is he? Oh, man, he must have $200,000 in stock. And so we measure a man's achievement by the money that he accumulates or the salary that he's getting per year, the kind of house he lives in, and all of that reflects the kind of money he makes. And so the measurement of our success is money. Now, in the Christian ministry, what is their measurement of success? It's people. And so if we're going to be successful, we have to have gobs of people around. Man, we had a great conference. The great hall was full. And so we measure the success of something that we're doing by how many people we have. Now, you know, that gets diabolical. Because money is an inanimate object. It doesn't have a soul, and it's not going to get to heaven, or it's not going to go to hell either. It's just going to burn. But people are different. And how many times have you heard somebody say, now I want everybody out tonight? And probably a third of those people in their audience, the last thing they need to do is come out tonight. Maybe their marriage is falling apart, or maybe they have a kid that's ready to bail out. But he has to demonstrate that he's a faithful Christian by coming out four times a week. And he needs that like he needs another hole in the head. But why do we insist? Because we're really concerned about his good? Uh-uh. Because we've got to look good. We have to be successful in the ministry. And God help us when we do that. And it happens all the time. And you know it does, don't you? Well, I'm sure glad that we navigators are above that. We specialize in the individual. But you know, I remember when I first got going, I had this bunch of guys in the house. I'll tell you a little bit more about them later on tonight. About six guys living with me. And I'd come home, you know, real cool-like, and I'd say, witness to a guy today. The other guy's, oh, yeah? How'd you do it? Oh, it was really nothing. No. Now, why did I tell him that? Well, because I wanted to be a successful navigator, and so I wanted everybody to know that I'd witnessed that day. And once in a while, I would manage to get a decision out of somebody. That was always a special day, because I'd come home, and I'd wait for the right moment, and we'd be sitting at the table, and then, real cool-like, I'd say, let a guy to Christ today. And all the forks would drop, clink, and they'd say, man, how'd that happen? And I had my reward right there. You know? I wasn't concerned about whether the guy died the next day or not. Or whether he'd ever really met the Lord or not, or whether any real change had taken place or not. And I was just out to get my notches, you know? We Christians have got to be so careful that we don't use people as objects. But we manipulate to make us look successful in the ministry. Probably comes under the category of sin. Or we can treat people as projects. Now, you know, that the first time that really hit me was 11 years ago. We were on our way on a boat going south, heading for Brazil. It was the Delta Line and a combination freighter and passenger ship. 120 passengers and the rest was cargo. But they really treated us royally. It was quite a deal. But among those 120 passengers, there were 60 missionaries. And so it was one-on-one, you know. 60 missionaries and 60 non-Christian people. 60 pros against 60, you know, other people. Well, you know, riding on a boat is quite an experience because you get out there, and you get away from land, you can't see anything, and so you look up in the bow, and all you can see is water, And you look out the stern, and there's more water out there, and you look out the starboard, and there's water, you know, over there, and then you look out the other side. I'm not a sailor. What do you call the other side beside the starboard?
Port.
And what's that, the right or left side? Okay, left out. Phew, I lucked out. So you look out the left side, port side, and there's water, and then you've seen it. You've seen the scenery. See? Well, there's a swimming pool about the size of this pulpit, and you get in there and splash around in that a little bit. The sun's so hot, you have to get in the shade. You play, you know, dead tennis for a while, and that's a gas. And so, what else is there to do? So you sit and talk to people. There ain't anything else to do anyway, you know. So I kind of like a weasel in a chicken house, 3 days out, and, you know, all day long, night and day, talking about Jesus. See, and these people just eating it up. Well, then I got to worrying. I thought, man, you know, there are 60 Christians on this boat, and I've already gone over my quota. I'd better check in, or we're going to have people going overboard just to get away from us. So one day I was walking across the deck, and there were these six missionaries sitting down. And so I sat down with them, and I said, you know, fellas, we need to get our signal straight here. I've been talking to the Futures and the Bells and Abreu. I named off a few people. And I said, now, who are you guys talking to? And there was a long silence. And one fellow spoke up and he says, well, some of us just got out of seminary and we don't know how to do that. And another said, well, I've been a pastor for 3 years, but I've never really tried to do that. I've never led anybody to Christ. Another fellow says, well, I don't know. He says, I have some reservations about this conversion thing. And so I had some comments to make to the effect that, well, we have 16 days on this boat, and it's on a one-to-one ratio. We're going to a country of 100 million people, and if we can't do it on a one-to-one ratio in 16 days, what makes you think we're going to do anything in Brazil? We might just as well catch the next boat north, and so on. Well, then I left. Well, the next day, three other fellows came to me. They knocked on a cabin door, and they came in and they said, Jim, we've talked to the ship's captain, and we've gotten permission to hold a church service for the ship's crew. Now, they're out at sea sometimes 3 months at a time, and they never get to go to church, and so we feel that they really need to have a church service. And so we've gotten permission to use the galley, that's the dining room for you land lovers, and we've gotten permission to use the galley, and we'd like to have you speak. And I said, well, I said, now that's funny. I said, I'm the only layman among you. And I went to art school, crying out loud. So, but then I said, besides, I don't think I can accept it because they don't believe in it. And he said, well, what do you mean? Well, then I told him a story about a fellow that I'd gotten to know who was a pastor, a fellow by the name of Cliff. And I'd talked to him just 2 or 3 weeks before, and the story was fresh in my mind. We were sitting at the table having dinner, and he says, you know, Jimmy, he says, the people in my church, he was a pastor, he says, the people in my church have really gotten into this witnessing thing. I said, how's that? And he says, well, the kids, he says, every Sunday afternoon, they go to the old folks' home. And boy, he says, they preach, and then afterwards, you never see any of them sitting around. They're there talking to those people about Jesus. And then he says, and now the men in the church have gotten onto it, too. And I said, well, what are they doing, Cliff? He says, well, he says, they're going to the jails. And I said, Cliff, you know what you're doing? As you're teaching those people that the gospel is for those people that can't fight back. You never pick anybody your own size. You always go to somebody who's in a disadvantageous situation. Now, if you're going to produce people who are witnesses, teach them to pick on somebody their own size. Now, it's not that these people don't need Christ, but don't let that be their witnessing program. And I said, now, you guys are the same way. I got through to you yesterday, and now your conscience bothers you, and now you think of these poor sailors here. Now, you know very well that what God wants you to do is to talk to the passengers, but you don't have the courage to do it. They said, well, what do we do? We've already got it set up. And I says, well, don't ask me. Well, they put the pressure on. I said, well, I'll go along, but I won't speak. And so I was there, and there were five missionaries sitting there waiting for the sailors to come pouring in for this service. And once in a while, one would come into the galley in the course of duty.
and he had seen the announcement, so he'd go streaking through the, well, he'd go running through the gap.
Better watch your language around here. This is a Christian gathering. So he'd go running through the galley, and then these fellows would holler, "Hey, we're having a service. Come join us." And he'd take off, really go, you know. Well, we sat around. Nobody came. And finally, one sailor came in, and he came in and sat down. We got talking to him and found out that, lo and behold, he was a Baptist. So we had our service. And I really felt, you know, it was just a bad scene. And I kind of had a laugh, though, because I think the Lord was on my side. And he showed those people that that was not the thing to do. So they figured that out. And a couple days later, there was a fellow in the group, among the passengers, a retired gentleman of about 68 years old, who was having a birthday. And he was a dear Christian. That cut it down, 58. His wife was a Christian, too. They're 58 non-Christians, 62 Christians. But anyway, he was having a birthday, and so they organized, the missionaries organized an old-fashioned sing. Well, I could see that thing coming. And so I was way up on top, in the top part of the ship. You know, you sailors, what do you call it, top part of the ship? Well, I was up there, anyway. And I knew that, you know, down there, so I knew what was going to happen. And there was one other fellow that happened to miss the old-fashioned sing, and he was up there, too. And it just happened we were talking about Jesus. And so down below, we could hear them singing Old Kentucky Home and Suwannee River and stuff like that. And then Rock of Ages. And How Great Thou Art. And there was a long pause. And there was another hymn. Another long pause. And another hymn and a longer pause. And I knew just exactly what was going on. Well, see, but the missionaries really thought they'd succeeded. They'd gotten all those people together to hear. And so they figured, well, man, we can't, you know, this is success. Let's not stop now. So they called another old-fashioned sing 2 days later. And there were 59 of us up on top. Why is it that when we think about reaching somebody, we have to organize some deal? And when we go to talk to somebody, instead of just going and talking to them, we put this dumb block of wood between us and the people we want to talk to. Just go talk to them. There they are. But we always have to have a project. And we treat people as projects. And we, to minister to them, we organize them first. That's not the way to relate to people. And I thank God that we navigators are above that. But let me tell you about my first nav home.
It was in 1958, I think it was. And it was in Minneapolis. And the area representative at the time was Bob Gartner, and he was getting married. And I'd been married for 4 years already, and so I was kind of an old hand at that, but Bob was, that was a new deal for him, and so he didn't want to have these six fellows that he'd been living with, you know, he didn't want to bring a bride into a household of seven men, and so he asked me to take the six men and he'd take the bride, and so I said, fine. So we rented a four-story house, you know, 3 stories up on top and one big basement, and we filled it up with fellows. And I'd never laid eyes on those guys before in my life. And I'd never even been around Harding the Navigator before. But I'd kind of heard about what navigators do, and we tried to do everything just right, you know. Everybody had an area to keep clean, and when they'd use the wash basin, they'd wipe it out afterwards, and then they'd hang their towels three ways, fold them three ways, so that they'd be sure and not dry before the next person came to use them. And we had home nights, you know, where everybody'd get together and talk about what was going on, what was good and what was bad, and then we'd study the Bible for a couple of hours, and everybody had their Bible study done, and then we'd check out on verses, so then I'd meet with all these guys individually. They'd come up, and I'd sit down, and we'd talk for an hour, and
When the hour was up, I'd say, okay, next.
The next guy'd come in. So,
it was funny. Those guys are strangers when they came into the house and lived with me for a year. And it was strangers in and strangers out. You know why? Because those guys were a project to me. I was trying to be a successful NAV home leader. And so I had this navigator home leader image on. You know, full-size, you know, body-sized mask. Navigator home leader. I'd go around like this, you know, keep my image in front of me. And there, nobody ever saw behind me. Anybody tried to, I'd back up and they wouldn't be able to see me. And so those guys, you know what they did? They did what they were obligated to do. They wore navigator home dweller images. And so you know how that works. We had breakfast at 6:15 in the morning. You know, it had to be that way, just, you know, because God loves austerity. And so we'd have breakfast at 6:15 in the morning, and they'd come down, you know, with good attitudes. Because that's what navigator home dwellers do, is have good attitudes. And so they were playing their game, and I was playing my game, and it was just 1 year-long masquerade. They were a project. And boy, I wish I could go back and undo. Every once in a while I meet some of these guys, and I apologize to them for the way I related to them. And I didn't discover it until one day one of the fellows came to me and he says, you know, Jim, he says, you don't love us. And, you know, I just died because he was right. So I wasn't giving myself. I was protecting myself. I was trying to look good. I was trying to be successful. And the essence of love is selflessness. And you don't minister to people. You can't really get into the lives of people unless you love them. And you can't love people if you're playing games with them, if you're using them or manipulating them for your own ends. Well, how do we deliver ourselves from this? Well, you know, there's a passage in Matthew chapter 22, which is an amazing passage. I'd like to have a turn to it. Matthew chapter 22. In two phrases, believe it or not, Jesus summarizes the whole Bible. In these two verses. And not only does he summarize the whole Bible, but he summarizes life. And he tells us where we're going to find meaning in life. In these two phrases. Matthew 22:36-39. One of them, a lawyer, asked him a question. Just to test him. Teacher, what is the great commandment in the law? And he said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. Now this is the greatest and foremost commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love the neighbor, your neighbor, as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets. You see? The whole law and the prophets are based on these two commandments. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, and your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. Now, really, all he's talking about here is three relationships. And he says, once these three relationships are what they should be, you've arrived. That's it. See, Christianity isn't very complicated, is it? Just take care of three relationships and you've got it made. Love the Lord your God and your neighbor as yourself. Now, we do not really understand that. We think that meaning is found in other things. And that's why a guy will, you know, bust himself to get into a certain profession. Because he says, man, if I can get that profession, I'm going to be fulfilled. Or a person has an idea of what kind of a house he wants to live in, what kind of a life he wants to live, what his lifestyle is going to be. He says, man, if I could get into that, or if I could travel, or, boy, if I could just have my weekends free to fish and hunt, or if I could just find a wife that would let me watch TV from Saturday noon to Sunday night. Or, and so we think of all those things that we feel would really, you know, be, make life enjoyable. But I tell you that none of those things give meaning to life. And if you pursue them, you're going to wind up empty. And there is only one way, only one source of meaning in life, and there's only one way that you are going to be fulfilled, and that is by being very careful to fulfill these two commandments. That is, to groom those three relationships. The relationship with God. And what's the second one? Huh? Yeah. Love yourself. Now, the Eastern religions teach us to divorce ourselves from ourselves and divorce ourselves from the material to try to somehow attain the spiritual. Not Christianity. It says, love yourself, and then you can love your neighbor. And with these three things, you are going to be a fulfilled person. Now, it's really interesting that God would invite us to love her, love him. Have you ever tried to look at that from God's point of view? He says, worship me. And the psalmists, I, for a long time, they just kind of drove me up the wall. They were not only content to saying, no, I want to praise God, and I praise God, and I'm glad that I can worship him and everything. But, you know, they'd call on everybody, they'd order everybody else, you know, praise God. You've got to praise God. They'd even double rocks and trees and the lake there. You know, everything's got to praise God. And then we think of God as being this, you know, what does he do with this praise? Is he so insecure that he's got to have people telling him how great he is all the time so that it makes him feel good? Is that what it is? Well, you know, when God invites us to praise him and to worship him, that is not an invitation to go to church. That is an invitation to enjoy him. And so, when I am enjoying God and just basking in that relationship, and when I'm with a buddy and talking about what God is doing in my life, where is the focus? It's on God. And as I focus on God in my worship and my praise, I take the focus off of myself and I'm delivered from myself. And so God calls on me to worship him and to praise him for my good. He is delivering me from myself when he calls on me to worship him. Now, we can't go on and expand this loving God with all our heart, soul, and mind. We could spend a week on that, you know. But there's just one thing I want to call your attention to here. In 1 John 1, verses 6 and 7, he talks about walking in the light. And in verse 7, he says a very interesting thing. And of course, walking in the light is walking in the presence of God or in the orientation of God. God is light. And the Word is light. Christ says, I am the light of the world. And so when we are in that context of the presence of God, then we are walking in the light. And he says a very interesting thing here. He says, if we walk in the light as he is in the light, this is 1 John 1:7, we have fellowship with whom? One another. Now, isn't that interesting? You'd think it would say, if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with him. But what does the fact that I walk in his presence have to do with my ability to relate to you as an individual? That's what that verse says. But I cannot really relate to you if my relationship with God is not what it ought to be. How's that? Well, what happens when I walk in the light? What's that? Yeah. Sin is revealed. You remember in Isaiah chapter 6, where Isaiah said, I saw the glory of the Lord. And when he saw it, he says, woe is me. For I'm a lost cause. I'm undone. For I'm a man of unclean lips. I dwell in the land of men of unclean lips. And he was just scared, witless, when he stepped into the light, because he saw himself as he really was. Now, that is what happens when you walk in the light. And let me tell you, if you think that you're really doing pretty well as a Christian, and that you have the major things in your life pretty well ironed out, and that just, you know, a little bit more of the same, and you're just going to be one of the saints, I have news for you that you haven't been in the light lately. So when I step into the light, I see myself as I really am. And what do I discover? I discover that I am a forgiven sinner. Present tense on the sinner business, okay? But I haven't, I was a sinner back there, and God has really perfected me now. And all my problems are in the past. You know, that's how it is. We always talk about the crises that we have been through, the things we used to do that were wrong, but now everything's fine. Isn't that the way it goes? I just about got a lick now. Well, when we step into His presence, we discover that we are sinners being forgiven every day of our lives. Now, what does that do to me? Ephesians 4:32. Be kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven you. How has God forgiven me? He has forgiven me in an incredible way. Now, how in the world can I turn around and be judgmental with you? And so when I step into the light, the mask is gone. And I say, that's the way I am. I guess, you know, God knows it. I guess I can just kind of let it hang out, and everybody else can know it too, because it really does. The secret is out. And I can be myself, and I'm delivered from myself when I'm in the presence of God. And that brings us to the second relationship, the relationship with ourselves. And it is only as I am rightly related to God that I can be rightly related to myself. Because it's a tremendous discovery to learn that in spite of what I am, God accepts me and loves me. And you know, there are a lot of people in the world that are incapable of love. And they just better not get married, because they're going to blow it all to pieces. And the reason that they're incapable of love, many times, the basis is immaturity. But that's kind of a cheating word, because it isn't very specific. You always say somebody's immature, and we all are. But the reason is they can't accept themselves. And so they're all bound up in trying to put their own lives together to try to figure out who they themselves are. And so it's all inverted. And the consequence is that they cannot, they're incapable of giving themselves to somebody else. And so they can't relate. They'd be just better not get married until they get that worked out. You know, maturity is directly related to your knowledge of yourself and how well you know yourself. We hear a lot about self-image. And if any of you have read anything that Maxwell Maltz has written about self-image, you know, the field of psycho-cybernetics and this kind of thing, what he says is that the image that you have of yourself is like a fence around you, and it determines what you achieve. And so he calls on us to tear the fences down and become something that we never dreamed we could be. Well,
That might help. But God does a better job of it than that. But you know, it takes a lifetime to get to know yourself. And you cannot even begin to get to know yourself if you cannot bring yourself to be honest about yourself. One of the most dramatic experiences of my life was also one of the most painful experiences of my life. It was back to about 1963. I had just gotten to Brazil, and I was just trying to get things off the ground. I had just gotten a hold of the language and just had my first few contacts around me. And, man, I was uptight and tight and wired for sound, you know. And had another buddy there with me. And then my dear friend George Sanchez came down to visit us. And if you people don't know George, then you may not be able to appreciate what I'm going to tell you right now. But George observed me for a few days. And then he said, Jim, I have something to say to you. Fine, George. When do you want to talk about it? Well, whenever you want. Well, let's do it right now. You know, you're always curious, you know, has something to say to you about you, and you want to find out right away what it is. And so we sat down. That was a mistake. We sat down around the table. And my wife was there, and this other couple was there, and there was George. And then George began to describe to me what I was like. And he described my choleric temperament, how I used and abused and trampled everything around me to accomplish what I was out to accomplish. I couldn't believe my ears. For 30 minutes he sat there and described all of these things about me. It took me 3 months just to be able to breathe evenly again when he got through. He just laid me low. And so I walked around, just kind of limped around, wounded for a long time. But you know, it was one of the best things that ever happened to me. Because I discovered myself. I didn't know about myself. And they say that your strengths and your weaknesses are related. You tell me what your weaknesses are, and I'll tell you what your strengths are. You tell me what your strengths are, and I'll tell you what your weaknesses are. And so I began to see that these weaknesses also suggest that I have these abilities over here. And the problem was I didn't know what my weaknesses were, nor did I know what my abilities were. I didn't know who I was. And so I was just kind of devastating everything around me. And my dear friend George gave me some basic insights into myself. And it changed my life. So we need time with God. And time with faithful friends. Where the voice of God can be heard. And he puts his finger on those things that we need to know about ourselves. The temptation when we hear them and when we encounter them is to deny that they're true and run the other way because they hurt so much. But if we stop and listen and ponder, God will change our lives and we will grow up and we will be able to relate to people as people. We can stop playing games. And now we're ready for the third. Loving our neighbor. Now, essential to loving our neighbor is just one basic concept, and I've already given you, told you what it was. The idea is forgiveness. Be kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven you. Or we can use the word acceptance. Or we can use the word not judging. You know, it's interesting, in Matthew 7:1, Jesus says, judge not. It doesn't say, don't judge unjustly. Or it doesn't say, be sure you're fair when you judge. It just says, judge not. Now, we get that turned around. As a matter of fact, the typical relationship that we have with people is that we judge the people around us. We say, why is he the way he is? Man, look at that guy. Why can't he go on a diet?
But look at this guy. Look at the slob. You know, why can't he discipline himself? And then, you know, we have these problems. And so I say, well, my father, I come from a long line of fat men. And so I, you know, just in the family. Or, you know, you have a bad attitude. I'm masculine. See, I look at a different light when I talk about myself. And so what may be, you know, a bad temper on your part just may be masculinity when I look at it from my angle, when I talk about myself. And so we tend to judge the people around us and understand ourselves and excuse ourselves. Now, conversion implies that we turn everything around, and this is one of the things we turn around. We seek to understand, okay, why is he the way he is? What makes him tick? Why does she act the way she does? And we try to explain it. And as we try to explain it, we understand the person and we accept the person. But then we hold ourselves responsible for what we are because we know that we are free people. And it doesn't matter what my father was. I'm a victim of nothing. I hold myself responsible for what I am and what I will become. Because under God's power, I can become that. But it's these judgments that destroy our relationships. And you can see this in every relationship that you have. As soon as judgments emerge, man, you've got problems. The communication falls apart. For example, in a marriage. You know, guy meets a gal, and he thinks, wow, you know, I think I'll hang around a while. And so he invites her out, and they talk about non-consequential things. But he likes what he hears, and she likes what she encounters, and so they agree to get together again. And imperceptibly, but suddenly, they find themselves spending hours together. I remember when I was going with my wife. She lived in a girls' club, and the doors closed at 2 a.m. And we just barely made it every night. And we were always glad when Saturday came around because they closed at 3 a.m. And, you know, what do we do? How do we spend all those hours together? Talking. Just talking. Just sitting there talking. Well, what do you talk about? Well, you talk about things you never told anybody else before in your life. Isn't that the truth? You tell her about things that your aspirations you wouldn't dare tell your mother or your father or your buddies because they'd think you're proud or they'd think that you're just loony. But somehow or other, this little gal sits there and nods and, yeah, ooh. She understands you. And then she will tell you things, you know, things that she was afraid of when she was a kid, and things she'd like to do, but she never thinks she could. And so she'll describe all these things. You sit there, and you think, my, what a fascinating conversationalist she is. And so you just eat it up, and you just had this great time talking together. And you discover, now, why is it that you can talk about these things you never talked about with anybody else before in your life? Well, because you're totally accepting her. And he's totally accepting you. There are no judgments. And so you're just uninhibited. You're free to share your heart, your fears, your aspirations, everything. And so it is so cool, that relationship, that you think, man, we're meant for each other. Let's get married. And so the marriage occurs. Well, then there's a little subtle shift. You notice that, lo and behold, every morning without fail, she drops the toothpaste. Now, you don't want to say anything about a stupid little thing like that, but it bugs you. And so, you know, she'd go in the bathroom, begin to get dressed, and you just listen and clunk. There it is. You know, I got this illustration out of my own marriage. That happened. My wife was she's a toothpaste tube dropper. And so
One day I couldn't take it any longer. And so I heard this clunk. And I said, "Honey, is that the toothpaste?" And she said, "Yes." And from then on, she dropped the toothpaste every morning. Her hand shook when she picked it up. And then the wife will see things about the husband that she just didn't think were there before, and it bothers her. He leaves his clothes laying in a heap on the floor. Why in the world can't he hang them up? And then he notices that she does something else. And yeah, but you know, still on the honeymoon, we don't talk about it. But we make these observations, then we confirm these observations, and then we reconfirm them, and then we have this list of things. And pretty soon, walls of judgment have come up in the relationship. And then something goes wrong, something triggers it, and lo and behold, war. You drop the toothpaste every morning. Well, you don't hang up your clothes. Well, and so it goes. And those judgments that were there come out, and they begin to destroy the communication. But the marriage is young, they kiss and make up, everything's fine. 2 weeks later, out comes the same argument. They could have saved a breath if they recorded the first one, because they say the same thing the second time, which shows that they never resolved it the first time. And as time goes on, judgments come up over this and about that and about this, and pretty soon the relationship is just full of landmines, all kinds of judgments planted in the relationship. And it gets to the point where about all you can talk about without going to war is the weather and please pass the salt. And so a crisis occurs in every marriage where either it's a cold war from there on out. You just talk about salt and the weather and nothing else because you just skirt around everything else. Or you just keep having your hot war, just, you know, shouting at each other and things. Or you come to grips with those problems and you tear those judgments down, and that takes courage and many tears and the grace of God. And that's why I believe that it's very, very, very difficult to find a happy marriage where the both are not Christians. Margaret Mead is trying to come up with Plan B for marriage because, you know, success is so rare. But that's the problem. The grace of God is not in a home. Judgments are going to abound, and two people can't live that way. Now, you extend that to the relationships with the people around you when you're trying to communicate with people that don't know Christ. And you're judging them all the time. And you wonder why you're not communicating the gospel, why people don't get saved. Well, they're afraid of us because they feel like they've fallen into the hands of a reformer. Here's this non-Christian. We go to talk to him. And what does he pick up? What do we telegraph? That we don't like the way he smells. We don't like what he puts in his mouth. We don't like the way he spends his time. And so we're bent on recreating him into our own image. We have judged him, and there's no communication. And in making disciples, we look at people, we try to train somebody, but what we've done is we've already judged him, we already decided that there's certain things about him we don't like, and we're going to change by, you know, come water, high water, we're going to change him. And what happens is that our communication is destroyed, and there's really no relationship there. Probably the key passage for people who aspire to treat people as people and not as objects or as projects is 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Let's take a look at this. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 19 through 23. This is one of my favorite passages. I think it's the handbook for people who aspire to work with people. Paul says, "For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all, that I might win the more. To the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might win the Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law. Though not being myself under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law. Though not being without the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I become all things to all men,
that I may by all means save some, and I do all things for the sake of the gospel, that I may become a fellow partaker of it. Now, question. According to this passage, who adjusts to who when we are ministering to a non-Christian or a new Christian or someone that we're trying to minister to? Huh? Yeah. We adjust to them. Now, don't think about that too long. It'll blow your mind. Who adjusts to whom? We adjust to them. We ask ourselves the question, how do I put this fellow at ease with me? How can I adapt to him so that he feels natural and accepted and unjudged with me? And so Paul said, when I'm with a person who's religious, man, I'm right with you, baby. And when I'm a person who's not religious, man, I'm like he is. And when I'm with a person that's, some other way, I'm like that. Good old wishy-washy Paul. No convictions of his own. He had a conviction. The conviction was this. I'm going to be all things to all men, but I'm up by all means save some. He was controlled by the law of love. Well, I've gone over my time here. I've got more to say, but I probably should quit. I don't know. Okay. Let me tell you a story. My dad is a... Maybe you want me to quit. My dad is a great Christian. And I owe more to him than I owe to any other man for what I have gained in the Christian life. He really faithfully brought me up in the Word. Well, he came down to Brazil to visit us a while ago. And I took him around to meet some of our brothers. And after he'd met a half a dozen of them, he went up and met this one fellow, who's a dentist, and went up into his office. And this dentist, says, man, I really want to thank you for Jim and what he's done in our lives and here in Brazil. And he said, I want you to know that I'm praying for my sister, your daughter, who hadn't come to Christ at the time. And my dad walked out of there with tears in his eyes. And he says, man, he says, I've never seen Christians like this in my life. And he says, Jim, how do you get them to grow like that? And I says, I don't know. How are you going to explain that? I just thought, well, watch and see, and you'll see. But what I didn't understand was that he wasn't going to see what he expected to see, and so he wasn't going to see anything. And so, because these were non-religious Christians, we have religious Christians, and we have non-religious Christians, and we handle them very differently, one from the other. And we try to keep them separate. And so, he watched, and he expected services, and, him singing, and certain procedures and things, and nothing. Once in a while, some guys would come over, and we'd sit down and, jack over the Bible for a while, and I'd take off the Bible under my arm, and there was nothing that was familiar to him. And that began to kind of bother him. He said, well, don't you do this, Jim? I said, well, not really. Well, don't you think that's important? Well, I don't know. It isn't Brazilian. And so then we went one day after being there for 3 weeks, and he was totally perplexed. We went to a wedding. And one of our fellows was marrying a girl that comes out of the German Lutheran background. And so it was just a full-blown church wedding, the kind you'd have any place here in the USA. Aisle, flowers, hymns, and they played a couple of hymns, How Great Thou Art, and I forget what the other one was. Of course, it was in Portuguese. But my dad came out afterwards, and I was standing out there in front of the church, and he said, boy, he says, that really spoke to me.
I said, what do you mean? He says, well, those hymns. I said, Dad, you don't understand a word of them. He says, well, and then it came together. You see, there's a very fine line between homesickness and a spiritual experience. Both of them are heavily emotional. And what my dad was looking for was the equivalent of what he knew back in the USA. And those equivalents had to be there if it was going to be all that, you know, the Christian ministry ought to be. Well, there was no great problem with Dad because he's a mature man. But this is the problem. A missionary goes to a country, and he looks around, and he's the only Christian in town. Sunday morning comes around, no Sunday school, no church service. And, man, he almost feels like a non-Christian himself. He feels guilty. He says, oh, man, how am I going to, I got to go to church. And so, but there's nothing to go to. So he thinks, well, I guess I got to get my own. And so he goes around and rounds up some people, and he invites his neighbors, and, you know, they're always intrigued by this foreigner, a little bit kooky, can't speak the language very well and things. And so, hey, yeah, I'll come. And so they come over to this American's home, this missionary's home, and they walk in the living room, and they think, man, those Americans, they're really funny people. Look at there. They got their chairs in the middle of the floor in rows. I wonder why they do that. Well, let's humor them along. And so they sit down, and think, well, that's the way the Americans do it, I guess. They sit in rows, and so they sit there, and wonder what's next. And so the American stands up, and lo and behold, he begins to talk to them, and he gives them 3 points, and then gives them a poem at the bottom. And you know, that's a funny way to converse. But they think, well, that's the American. And they go, and they're sort of intrigued by the foreignness of it. And so they invite him. They come back the next week, and the missionary, he feels good because he went to church. And so during the week, he furiously goes to work, and he translates some hymns. And so the next time they all come in, they sit down. They're used to that already. And he says, now we're going to do something else. And he teaches them this song. Well, now, they're used to samba, and they're used to a few other things, but here's this psalm, or this song, with a cadence they've never really heard before. And then another very strange thing happens. As they sit there and sing it, this American does funny things with his arms. And they can't figure that out, but that's okay. You see what we do? We have it all figured out, what Christianity ought to look like.